How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is Ronan Percival, the founder of Forest. He bootstrapped Forest to become one of the biggest providers of salon software in the entire world, right here in Dublin. Here's my chat with Ronan. Ronan, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Yeah, delighted to be here.
A pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
An OG of the Irish business scene at this stage, yeah, despite your tender years.
That is a god-awful thing to think of yourself, but yeah, it does feel like that now. 21 years. Oh my God.
You said something brilliant when we were chatting earlier. You were like, I'm just interested in going long. What does that mean?
So I guess I was as a kid, I always wanted to have my own business. I just knew I'd have my own business. Just always knew that. I don't know. People I knew didn't have the same thought I did. I just knew I would. And as I probably had that thought from maybe the age of 9 or 10 or something like that. When other people were thinking about, like, you know, Liverpool winning the first division or something, I was thinking about the branding on the trucks that I was going to have working for me.
Where do you think that came from?
Probably my dad had his own business as well. It was just him. He was a sole operator, like, but he sold food into hotels and restaurants around the west of Ireland. This would have been in the 80s, so, you know, they were kind of like, it was called Rare Foods, and it was things like pheasant and venison and artisan cheeses and stuff like that. So it was kind of like back before that stuff.
Back before it was cool.
It was very, yeah, exactly. So he did that, and, you know, I'd have gone out in deliveries with him, loaded the van the morning before school. You know, I would have been part of that, plucking the pheasants even during pheasant season.
We won't do the rhyme. Stuff. Huh? We won't do the rhyme.
Yeah, yeah. So people used to say that rhyme in school, and it applied to me. I was a pheasant plucker's son. Like, where did that come from? You know. But so I did all that, or I had that. So I kind of would be looking at my dad's business and always telling him he needs to hire more trucks. And I mean, I didn't really understand the business, but I'd be like, why don't you hire more trucks and sell them to more restaurants or whatever? So I was always thinking that way. And he wasn't really, you know, he wasn't into that at all. So I'm going to have to go and have my own business then, where I can do what I want. So I kind of had those thoughts from an early days, and then that morphed into, you know, went to college here in Dublin, met people like-minded who also wanted to start a business. And the two people I met who thought that way were, one was Dylan Collins, who's a fairly well-known entrepreneur now, and another guy, Sean Blanchfield, as well. And the three of us were like, right, we're going to have our own business. Didn't know what it was going to be. But I was always thinking, yeah, we're going to do this business, but in my mind, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. Like, this wasn't like going to have a business and sell it in 5 years and then do another business, like the serial entrepreneur or the, you know, that catchphrase or whatever. I just never thought that. Like, I was like, no, I'm doing this for the long run. And then over time, and that kind of morphed into this idea that your life, you know, this is going to be your life's work, I guess, is probably the way I describe it now. Like, having your own business and building it, creating it, developing it, and seeing where it goes over your lifetime. So that's 40 or 50 years or more, you know, whatever that amount of time is, but a long time. And that idea just appealed to me, and it just appealed to me when I was in my early 20s, and has just stuck. And
it's so fascinating.
It appeals to me more now than it did then, you know. So,
because especially like in tech, especially, there's such a rapid pace and such a rapid pace of development, and it can sometimes lead to short term thinking and, you know, flips and, you know, exits and mergers, and it can seem like a very short term world. So it's fascinating that was just in you.
Yeah, and I think like tech, we say tech, like when I was really young, I didn't, you know, tech, there was no such thing as tech, like, you know, or you didn't think of tech in that way. I've now been in tech over 20 years because the businesses that we did start in the end were tech. And the business we started, myself and Sean and Dylan started, was a tech business. And so, you know, from that point on, it's been tech. So that idea of tech being moving faster or whatever was all new to me at that time, do you know? But it makes sense. I mean, in tech, technology moves quickly. So companies come in and out of, you could say in and out of fashion, but in and out of usefulness as well. Do you know what I mean? If they don't evolve. And if you're very successful at doing something and solving something, it can be quite hard to evolve. And like today, that was kind of a more accepted kind of view. And I mean, today, you know, when you have your Googles and Facebooks and Amazons and stuff, and they're all like massive and they're not going anywhere because they're constantly able to adapt to the new technologies, or if it's AI or whatever, they're able to just, you know, kind of consume that and make it part of what they are.
Then there's such a relevant scale as well. Yeah, you know, they're not going to get blown over by a stiff wind.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But for smaller tech companies, it is more likely that you create something that's successful and then you sell it before it becomes, you know, not useful. Do you know what I mean? And that seems to be a fairly,
I think in Ireland as well, that seems to be, maybe it's a bias thing here. We kind of just see it. We think it's more prevalent here. Is it more common in Ireland, do you think, for smaller companies to get gobbled up?
I would say, I'd actually say no. Compared to the world at large, I'd say no. I think, like, if you went to America, you know, companies are gobbled up all the time as well. But it's such a big company or big country, and it has so many huge tech companies. Usually,
yeah,
the names that you think of aren't being gobbled up. But like, there's constant, you know, startups and smaller companies are constantly being acquired and stuff like that. So I think it happens there. We just don't have that many truly massive tech companies. So we do have one. I mean, some, I suppose, is someone like Stripe or something like that. You could say is a huge tech company, although it's technically wasn't really started here.
Debate.
Yeah, yeah, that's a whole different
tomato
thing.
Tomato.
But like, there's not that many companies like that. Do you know what I mean? So of that scale, like, let's say. So when you're a smaller scale, you are more likely to be gobbled up. Do you know what I mean? So I think that I understand that now, but it definitely frustrated me. I used to write blog posts about this like 10 years ago. It used to frustrate me how people have a good idea, it's going well, and then they'd sell, do you know? And that seemed to be what everyone wanted you to do. The investors wanted you to do that. You know, the founders, who, you know, everyone wanted you to do that. So
over the past 5 years in this podcast, I've spoken to loads of amazing Irish business who grew from one idea, become world-class companies, able to compete with the very best on the international stage. And many of those started up and grew with the help of their local enterprise office. From starting or growing to becoming more sustainable or digitization, the local enterprise offices have everything to help make it happen for your business. And if there's one thing that entrepreneurs want, aside from more money, it's more time. The local enterprise offices want to give that back. Their supports for competitiveness and productivity can help your business save time, money, and energy. For them, it's all in a day's work. So if you want to give your business the gift of time, decreased costs, and lower electricity bills, then go to allinadayswork.ie, take 2 minutes to fill out the form, and let your local enterprise office handle the rest. If you've been listening for a while, you know Iconic Offices have been my partner for ages now. Working and recording out of their flexible workspaces has meant a huge deal to the success of this podcast. So it made perfect sense to partner up with them again for season 17, but to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, a unique offer. Come work in the Iconic Office workspaces for free with no catches. Simply visit the link in the description below and enter Gary24 for a free day pass or a free day office pass. Enjoy.
So you want more people to think long?
Well, it's just I didn't want to. Yeah, like for me personally, like that just didn't hold any attraction to me. Like, you know, like this
didn't
idea.
Didn't want
to
get rich quick?
Yeah, like I don't want to sound like, oh, I'm Mother Teresa or something and I don't want to get rich. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I, you know, somebody gives me, you know, a load of money, I'm not going to give it away. Oh, I might give some of it away, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to say no or whatever. But I don't think, but it just doesn't excite me. Like the idea of building the company, I find much more exciting and satisfying and also stimulating to use my brain in that way. Do you know what I mean?
So when you started with Dylan and Sean, what was the idea?
So we had loads of ideas actually. And the first, we'd loads of stuff. Like I saw a list the other day. We had like 10 company ideas, and they were like stuff like, we had this idea of a company called CelticBreeze.com, and we bought that domain. And the idea was that was basically Irish arts and crafts sold online. But this is like 2001 or something. Do you know what I mean? So .com, early .com boom, or even earlier than 2001, maybe 2000 something. So we ideas like this generally, we're just like, we're going to create a .com or whatever. And it's interesting, some of those ideas, like Celtic, that's like Etsy now or something. Do you know what I mean? Like there's the thing, and that kind of taught me something as well. You have loads of ideas, and all the ideas are probably fairly good, but it's actually executing them and getting them actually working properly. And
I was going to ask you, you know, like, is because the key, you know what I mean? Was there anything you looked at and went, oh, that's a gem.
Yeah.
Is there anything we can look back now and go, oh, that would have been?
Well, one of the things we, well, a couple of things that we did. So first of all, we started a text message business when we were in college, and we called it Text by Numbers. And basically what we did was we collected phone numbers from people in college. So we went around the Buttery, which I think is gone now in Trinity, and the pubs where people be hanging out in the summer, and we used to just collect people's phone numbers because mobiles had just come out maybe the year before, and people had just started texting because phones came out for a year or two, and then people started texting, I think 2000 or something, the first text message sent. So people were texting, and we just got all the names and numbers and wrote them down. We collected maybe 1,000. And in those days, there's no GDPR. So you just go, can I have your phone number? And people would go, yeah. Because there's like...
Sounds great.
But nobody
I'd
had
love to get a text.
Nobody ever thought, yeah, deadly, I'll get a text. And we say, yeah, we'll just send you some texts on stuff, cool stuff, maybe places to go or whatever.
Cool.
They're like, yeah. So you just collected 1,000. I remember we were going, like, we're going to collect 1,000. So it took us like a week or two to do that. And then we found this company in Limerick that sent bulk text messages. So we built a little web page that could do it sitting on top of that thing. And then we went to bars and nightclubs all around Trinity. Mm. So like there was a place called Pegs. I don't know if any of these mean anything, but there was the Pod, and there was all these kind of the Kitchen. And it was quite a good, in those days, like there was a massive nightclub scene in Dublin, which doesn't really exist now, but it was like huge then.
And the student market is huge.
Yeah, and it was just like students and get them in. Vodka Red Bull for €3 kind of thing, yeah. You know. And so we went to these places and just said, like, we'll send a text message out for whatever, €100, and we just put an offer on it, and if they show it on their phone, they can get in and get this offer or whatever. And that just went gangbusters. Like, I remember for that place, Pegs, it was like a Tuesday night, we sent out the text and it was a queue. I remember we went round onto Nassau Street and it was just a queue of students, like, all the way down Nassau Street. Like, do you know what I mean? And we were just like, we did that. Like, you know, it was a great buzz, you know?
Yeah, the power and effect. Like, there's nothing better as an entrepreneur when you see the first idea come to life and you physically see it. It's oh, my God.
As soon as you do, you have these ideas and then you do it and you see it come to life like that, it just strengthens your belief that, wow, we can do cool things. You know what I mean?
Build things.
Build on it or do whatever. So we did that, and there was a load of stuff we did there. I remember we did the first marketing campaign by text for a brand, which is for Smirnoff Ice at the time. And basically it was, it sounds stupid now, but it was something like, you texted in a number. If you texted a number, they sent you back the Smirnoff Ice logo in like that, like this is pre-smartphone, like in this like, you know, pixelated kind of logo thing that you could put on your phone. So when you started your phone, it had the Smirnoff Ice logo.
Yeah, yeah.
Why someone would want to do
the
that
old
now.
Nokia thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, it would just come up there on the Nokia or whatever. So, and we did that. And it's the first time anyone had done a marketing campaign by text. And because we were still in college, all the marketing agencies and companies, like, they didn't even really know how phones worked. Like, you know what I mean? At that point, you know, they weren't used to it. So, and we did that. I remember doing that. And I think they paid us like €1,000 or something. Or was it £1,000? I can't remember. Yeah. When did the euro come in? It was actually then too. Might have been £1,000. And we were like, that's the most money we'd ever seen in our life. And it was cool as well, because like, we would have all had jobs, you know, working in a takeaway or a spa or whatever while we were in college. And now we were making money for doing stuff that was kind of cool. And
you're having fun with
thing.
Your friends.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So we did that campaign. And I just remember, I actually can't remember if it worked or not. But what I do remember is they wouldn't pay us. And it wasn't Smirnoff Ice, it was whoever their marketing agency was, right?
Yeah.
And they wouldn't pay us. And we used to ring them, we had to go to the payphone to ring them. I'm not sure why, probably didn't have any credit or something. So we have to go to a payphone and ring them and constantly say, you know, we're the accounts receivable here, and we haven't got the money yet or whatever. And they knew that, look, it was out in the street.
You probably didn't want to seem like it was coming from a phone. Yeah, but
they must have heard we were out in the street, you know, like they'd have known, and they knew who we were fucking students, like, so sorry, am I allowed to
say
this?
Yeah. Go for it.
So they, I'm sure they knew well, so they just wouldn't pay us. For ages. Yeah, yeah. And in the end, what we did was and this is actually something, was a big lesson as well. We just started texting the lady, the manager in there, just start texting her every hour saying this money was outstanding. We did that, and it went, that went on all day. And then the next day, she rang us and said, stop fucking texting me. Here's the money. So we were like, cool. I'd say we were probably the first people ever to use text messaging to collect bad debts. Back
into I hate that, though, when people do that to early stage entrepreneurs. They squeeze you. Oh, it's net 60, net 90, net 120. And you're like, small businesses are relying on this.
Yeah. So we were like, cool. No one's ever going to owe us money again because we're going to fucking make their life a misery if they do, you know? So, so that was...
So that was your first big win.
That was the first big win. Yeah, yeah. That was cool. But the thing was, we kind of felt that with text messaging, that was cool, but it was basically a medium. Like, it wasn't like we were like controlled text messaging. Like, it wasn't like, right, we're going to be a bulk text messaging. That's going to be our idea for a company. We were like, this is just to help get us going. And really what we want to do is something deeper or more, you know, more meaningful or something like a really cool technology thing. And Sean Blanchfield, who became the CTO of Demonware, he was working on his PhD, and it was basically like a distributed systems kind of thing. So basically it was this idea that computer games, it was really expensive to do computer games online at the time, because it's not like today where you have AWS and just a totally different scale of providing online connectivity and things like that. In those days, everyone's still on dial up. You know, having a server in a server farm or something like that is like massively expensive, you know. And if you wanted your own website, then you actually had to go and buy a server somewhere. Do you know what I mean? And put it in yourself, into a location. You know, it was a huge amount of work. So when computer games were starting to be played online, it was massively expensive for the computer game company. So he was working on this idea, peer-to-peer networking idea, similar to Skype. So if you remember, I don't know if you remember, Skype was really innovative at the time because it didn't require a server. You spoke directly to
one end. You
used the power of your PC on each end to do the call, so it didn't need the server. And at the time, that was needed from a cost point of view. You couldn't have scaled Skype. They'd have needed like infinite resources, in terms of the cloud and everything like that to fund it, which wouldn't have been possible to do free calls, right? So that allowed it to be free. So that was the idea. So it was like, we'll take that concept and apply it to computer games and have people play computer games to each other where it's peer-to-peer, and then you don't need these, you know, hugely expensive, you know, server infrastructure or whatever. So that was the idea. It was a cool idea. It was, at the time, it was really cutting edge. And so we had this business going, doing the text messaging. We left college. So we left college in 2002. We had enough money coming in. We probably had a grand or something a month coming in, enough to rent an office on Talbot Street, which was like just a complete dump of a tiny, it was a room, tiny little room that could fit like five people sitting around one desk, one massive desk table. Like, and we all went in there, and it was like £300 a month or whatever it was, €300 a month. And we were like, right, let's get this thing off the ground. And, so we kind of split, it was me, Dylan and Sean, and then we had two other people who joined us as well. And we basically kept selling the text messages to more and more types of businesses, like sports clubs and lots of different people to send out reminders or send out messages, and then raise money for this idea, the computer games idea, which we did. Like, we raised 700,000 back then when people didn't, there was no such thing as seed, like we didn't even call it a seed round. Like, there was no, that terminology wasn't even used in Dublin, you know, like people didn't.
Jeez, that's big money then.
Young people didn't raise money either. Like, we didn't know anyone our age 20 years ago out of college who'd raise money. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was a kind of and most investors, they kind of look at you funny, do you know? It wasn't a thing. It became more of a thing over the following 10 years.
Yeah. So how did you raise that much?
Yeah, it took a year. Like, we just, you know, angel investors, a small seed fund, DBIC, you know, like just Enterprise Ireland, just cobbled it together like from lots of different sources.
It's proper cash though, like, Jesus.
And it was great. It was a great experience to go out and raise that money and do all that kind of thing. But it also led me to this point where I realized that didn't feed into what I wanted to do with building a business. Because when all that stuff is brand new to you, you just raise money. But like when you raise money, you're now on a train that's going in a certain direction. And if you want to go somewhere else, that train is on those tracks. It can't just, it's not like a car that can just go turn left and just change your direction. You're on that train. And once you raise money, you have to give a return to your investors or you wipe them out. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm saying that's really bluntly. Obviously that happens over 5, 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
But they're expecting you, you know, you can't just walk away from that. Do you know what I mean? Or you give up everything or whatever. So I realized that, okay, so now it became really apparent to me. You know, I remember sitting down with Dylan after, right, we've raised the money. We've found a new office around the corner, Middle Abbey Street. We're starting to hire like the devs that we're going to need to build this thing. And the objective was, right, we just need to get, in 12 months time, we're going to run out of money, or, you know, we'd run out in 18 months, but in 12 months we need to have raised the next round. Mm. So what you'd probably call Series A now, you know what I mean? We'll need to have raised the Series A. So what do we need to do with the 700 grand to get us to raise the Series A, which is going to need to be, you know, a couple of million or whatever? What do we need to do? And in my mind, it was like, I thought we were building a business, but it felt like we were building something just to raise the next round, and then that round would help us raise the next round,
yeah,
help us raise the next round, and then we exit. And that's what we're doing. And that wasn't the kind of, that's what not what I'd signed up for.
Like, did you realize that as the round was closing? Did you realize that?
Yeah, and it was happening. It happened over the year as we were doing. Now, it was a brilliant experience, and they're fantastic guys. And, like Dylan and Sean have gone on to bigger things, and that was a big, you know, Demonware was a success. You know, it still exists. There's still like 50 people working for Demonware. It's part of Activision, you know, up there in Parnell Street. You know, it still exists 20 years later. So it was a big success, and it basically is the online, it's all the online capability for Call of Duty. That's basically what it is now. So whenever someone's playing Call of Duty online, it's on Demonware. Like, watch what we started. So like, it is cool. It is cool to think that's what it
then
was.
I'm a definite Demonware user. I played that a lot.
I'd like to point out, I had nothing to do with it, really. You know, I had nothing to do with that product or anything like that. So I'm not trying to claim any kudos for that, because that was all the guys, right? You know what I mean? But so that's all cool. But like, what wasn't cool was that, like, Demonware was always going to have to be sold, because it was just, you know what I mean? That was how you build those kind
of
heavy
clock
tech stuff in Ireland in particular. And then that, like, obviously what that does is it gives you money, it gives you an exit, and then you go on and you can do, it gives you experience, gives you a network, and you go on and you can build another company that's bigger and another company's bigger, which is what Dylan's done. And he's, you know, really successful at that. Mm. And I really admire it, because it's not how my brain thinks, you know what I mean? So I really admire the way he thinks, because it's very different to me. But yeah, we need to build a business here. I want to build a business that can go on for ever, or, well, forever is maybe a bit ridiculous, but like
your life's
for
work
for decades, yeah, you know, for my life. So so I realized it had to be bootstrapped. Like, that was probably the biggest insight I took for that. I can start a business, we keep building it. We had a name, Forest, so we had the name. Once Demonware got funding, I left. How we organized the split was, we actually stayed in the same building. They gave me a room. I took one of the guys that had been there, that was kind of interested in doing it with me, a guy called Jamie, and we were kind of more aligned on that, you know what I mean, on building the business.
So you had this other idea kind of cooking away at the back of your mind?
No, I didn't have an idea. So that's just to be really clear, we didn't have an idea. But what we did have was, we had a name, we had some sort of revenue from the text messaging, which, as the part of the deal was, I took that and sort of handed over, you know, my stake in Demonware in return for this thing that just got us going. And so, and Jamie was kind of up for that as well. And he was like, yeah, we want to do something. We thought, like, I prefer to do something for small business. That was about as far as it went. And it was just like, we want to help small businesses. And for me, that was helping someone like my dad, you know, who had a small business. I'd like to build software or something to help them do well. Like, that means more to me. You know, it got me kind of excited thinking about that. And he had some, you know, he had similar kind of feelings.
That's a class story. So, it's a mad story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it is really like, and when we talk, like for years, like if we would tell the founding story of Forest, we never really tell it like this because it's all, you know, it feels really complicated to all these things going on when, you know, people want to hear like, you had this idea, yeah, yeah. You did it.
They want the clean
against
version.
All the odds, yeah, you did yeah, it, you yeah. know what I mean, or whatever. But like the
give
reality
us, give
is,
give us the elevator pitch, Ronan.
Yeah, exactly. Constantly being told, like, can you say it in one sentence? Because I don't want to hear this like ramble about like how the hell you ended up here.
But I love but the that. That's what this pod is always about. Yeah. That's it's about digging underneath these stories and kind of learning because like they're the tangibles you want to give people because there's enough glamorization of startups and founders on Instagram and places like that. These are the real stories. These are the truths. Mm. And these are the honest human stories of like, for you to stay there would have been the easiest decision in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Would like it was, I really struggled with it. Like I remember really struggling with this idea of like, am I going to go off and do this on my own? But like Demo has just raised money. It's going to do well. Like, and it was really exciting. It was that startup kind of, especially it was like, you know, it was like a cloud startup, basically. You know what I mean? Like this equivalent to doing that back 20 years ago. It was like on the cutting edge of technology. You know, peer-to-peer was what people thought the future of networking was going to be.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Before the arrival of AWS and all that kind of stuff. Do you know? People felt that's what it was going to be. And so machines were getting more powerful in everyone's homes. That was kind of where the future was. And so, it felt like I was getting off that train. Was I a fecking idiot to do that? Like,
well, nine out of 10 people ain't getting off that train.
But I just went, no, I have to. Because, like, that's not, you know, not doing this just for that reason. Do you know what I mean? And, like, to be fair, it made sense as well. You know, and we were all, like, it was, you know, probably at the time felt like a better deal for them. Do you know what I mean? Like I walked away, you know, and stuff like that. But I was happier. And so, you know, I knew, you know, and I got some things from it that allowed me to get started. Do you know what I mean?
See the name.
Yeah.
Randomly enough. Okay.
I had a co-founder.
Co-founder and a little bit of cash coming in.
And so then what happened was we had this room and we just started to work out what we should do it started out with the text messaging. We just went back to that. And then we were like, let's do, and to be fair, this was Jamie's idea. He was like, why don't we do reminders? Again, I know like it's 2024, like this sounds so basic, I think today. But at the time that was like 2003 or something. Like it was like, wow, you know, let's do text message reminders and for loads of businesses. And we were going to do it for doctors and dentists and everyone. And we're like, that's a huge idea. And we'll save them all their no-shows and stuff like that, which is obviously cost the world. You know, we'd worked out, you know, 500 billion a year in missed appointments or something.
Definitely
whatever
huge
big
problem.
Number. It was
There's
a
no
huge,
doubt about
huge
that.
Number.
Yeah.
Right? So we like, we'll solve it with this thing. And then, so we built a really basic appointment screen that sent out reminders. And we were trying to get different businesses to use it. So we had like, again, I think we had about 15 businesses using it. We had a restaurant. We had like the Dublin Dental Hospital, you know, like a cherry picker company. Like we had random businesses using it that all had some sort of appointment, right? And we had a salon. And anyway, Jamie's girlfriend at the time owned a salon as well. So it was like, he was like, knew a little bit more about that. And so how it ended up was that we weren't earning very much money from the text messaging stuff. It was enough to sort of pay the rent and pay like a coder and stuff like that. But we weren't really able to take any money out. So I needed to go get a job. So I ended up going to work there just to kind of see was there opportunity for
where?
In a salon as a receptionist. Kind of to see if there was an opportunity, but also it paid the bills as well, you know.
I love that.
Rather than go and do some other stupid job, like, do you know, that would, or not stupid job, but another job that would
just something that would bring cash in. No, and
probably could have earned more money, but it would, like, it wasn't what I wanted to do, whatever. So we did that.
I love that.
And it just, it, a couple of things happened. So first of all, while we were there working reception in the salon, first of all, I fell in love with the industry. The first day I was working there, there's an amazing thing in a salon business which doesn't exist. I haven't seen it in other businesses. I'm sure it does exist in some businesses. But I'd worked behind a counter in jobs. You know, like I'd worked behind a bar, worked with barman Stag's Head for a year. You know, like worked in a spa or a centre. I can't remember what it was now, for like a year, third year in college. I'd worked in a takeaway in Rathmines for a year. So like I'd worked behind a counter where people are coming and you're taking money and you're serving them, right? I'd done that a lot. But doing it in a salon is very different because everyone comes up to you, comes in really excited to be there. Do you know what I mean? Like you don't, when someone comes to you in a shop or a dentist, they're not like really excited about coming in. So they
definitely
come
not
in,
the dentist
they
look, anyway.
Yeah, they're looking forward to getting pampered and whatever. And it's the highlight of a lot of people's week or a month. It's the bit of me time for people. And they come in, so you get that energy. It's like it's nice. Almost impossible not yeah. to pick up on that energy. And they come in, and then that you'd, you know, go, you know, take their coat or whatever, and say, you know, Sean is going to come out to you, or Lisa will be with you in a minute or whatever. And then they go, and it was a hair and beauty salon. They get like they get their hair cut, or they go. It was a beauty salon upstairs. They go get a treatment, and then they come back to the desk, and then they'd pay you, and you'd rebook them. But they'd be even better for them than they were like when they came in, which was good for them already. And it's very hard. Like my day went by, like within 2 days, I was like, it's mad how quick the day goes. Because when you're just having banter with people and it's friendly and happy, it's suddenly 6 o'clock and you go home and you're actually not knackered. Do you know what I mean?
That's not an easy transition though, Ronan, to like be the founder of a startup and then to go and work for someone else in an industry you've no experience in.
Yeah,
that can't have been an easy transition.
Well, it was. It kind of was for me, man. It meant I had a bit more money, actually. So I didn't mind. Do you know what I mean? I didn't mind.
Really quick break to thank today's sponsor. If you've been inspired by listening to The Amazing Business Person and either want to start your own business or supercharge an existing one, then the Local Enterprise Office has something for you. Whether you want to improve your online presence, become more sustainable, get into new markets, or just get the idea off the ground, they have the support for you. For more information, check out your local enterprise office on localenterprise.ie and see how they can help your business today. Now, back to the episode.
There was no ego there? There was no kind of like, oh, this is a step back?
Not really, because I knew I wasn't doing it forever, and it was fun to do it. Like, do you know what I mean? And I'd been doing jobs, similar-ish jobs, right, for all the years before that. So I didn't, you know what I mean? It was just something that... just felt natural to go and do. And anyway, when I was in there, like, so I didn't have a problem with that. And then I was having fun there. And then it was like quite clear that she had a big problem with no shows. So because I was there, they wanted to use their paper appointments. And they used the no, you know, they would use our thing because I was there, and I was there on the reception desk, and I would write the appointment in on the paper and type it into our little program. And we started sending out these reminders, and we cut down no shows like by about 85% almost immediately. Because, like, remember in those days as well, well, I don't know if you do remember all the way back in ancient history, but like people got texts and were like, what is this? You know what I mean? Like, everyone was like, oh my God, I got a text.
I worked in a phone shop from when I was 15 until I was, 21. Mm. And this was back, I'll date myself now as well. This was back in the early days of like 3210s and like the first couple of phones, Siemens C35.
Yeah.
And
remember them all.
It was unreal. Like, honest to God, I remember Christmas week, like the Aircel truck would pull up. And he'd bring in thousands of phones, and we would sell every single one of them that day.
Yeah, it was
it was bananas, because it was some. This sounds weird to say.
Yeah,
it was someone's first phone. I don't mean like a kid who's 15.
Yeah,
somebody coming in, they're 25, 30, it was their first phone, and this was like very rarely in life. I said this to someone the other day about it was actually he was having a baby. And I was like, very rarely in life do you get to do something for the very first time, and this was this bit of tech that just blew you away.
Yeah, and because that happened when I was in my late teens, early 20s. I kind of presumed all tech was going to be like that.
Yeah.
And like obviously it happened again with smartphones, which was the same kind of thing again. People went from their, you know, they were upgrading their normal block phone every year, and then they went to the smartphone, and that kind of transformed everything. But like, when was the last piece of tech since the smartphone came out that actually done that? There isn't really. There's new things, your Vision Pros or your watches and things.
But
they're
the
much
fringes.
More. It's much more kind of subtle. Like this was actually changed the way you
Changed the world, not to be dramatic, but it definitely changed the world.
And it's like the PC came out. I remember, you know, I was around for when that became ubiquitous. And then you had the phone thing. It seemed like every 5 years this was happening.
That's true, actually. And then I didn't think of it like that.
It hasn't been since, actually, weirdly. But so it was a very exciting time. It's an exciting time to be involved in technology. Like you're saying, being in that phone shop and just excitement. And even seeing the text going out for the salon. The salon felt like the owner, like her name was Tina, she felt like she was like really on the cutting edge. You know what I mean? And all the clients felt they were on the cutting edge receiving these things. And it was just like, this is a real hip salon doing this thing.
But the moment of joy, right? The moment, you said something beautiful there about coming in there in good form, they're leaving in good form. But also just like moments of joy, surprise and delight. That's what I'm trying to think of here. That surprise and delight moment. You know, a lot of stuff is very mundane. You go in and get your takeaway, grand, thanks. When someone gives you a little bit of a, like, oh, that's unusual, that's cool, oh, I like that. You know, it gives you a buzz, even if it's something mundane that you're doing.
It definitely does. And it's nice to give that to someone else as well, even though you're doing it over and over again. Yeah. But they're buzzing off you, and then you buzz off them. And it's really nice. And, like, so I knew a couple of things happened with that. First of all, it was like that feeling that we'd said about the queue, you know, down Nassau Street. Got that feeling about the reminder. Could see how happy Tina was, you know, small business owner, really, like, we'd saved her a lot of money. And then also getting that feeling that this industry was nice. Like, it was a nice industry. Like, and it's sometimes hard to explain to some people, but, like, if you're going to spend your life doing something, you kind of want to be around sound people. And it's not that there's not sound people in other things, but here was an area where we could use technology to help people and sound people as well, like a lot of sound people. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of, in every walk of life, there's a-holes, right? So it's not like everyone's nice, but on the whole, the vast majority of our customers who are salon owners are fairly sound. And a lot of them are very sound and they're lovely to work for and they're kind of appreciative of what you can help do for them, which is just a nice feeling to get, and at the same time encourages you to want to help them more. Do you know what I mean? Like, so that's nice, you know. And
me and Ben, before you came in, we're having a conversation about just what you want to do is you want to work with people who are consistent and sound.
Yeah,
they were our two criteria, just people who show up, do a good job, and are sound.
Yeah And like, not
goes
like
a long way.
Like, we you know, we talked about that, you know, that lady in, who I hope isn't listening to this podcast, she might be retired by now, so long ago, but she and I'm sure she's sound actually in her own life, but the lady working for that media agency, do you know what I mean, with the Smirnoff
thing. Yes.
And like, basically, like, that's a corporate working for a corporate, you know. Ultimately, we were getting paid by an agency who was doing something on behalf of some of Diageo, basically. And like, who gives a shit if like the CEO of Diageo makes an extra, you know, we help him increase his profits by an extra couple hundred thousand.
For a couple of days.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, who gives, in all that list of people that rolls up to that person, who gives a shit? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, who actually, do they give a shit? Yeah. Like, you're just doing it, it's just about money. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a bit of a buzz to it. Don't get me wrong. But the real feeling, whereas like, when you help like a small business, like was like my dad, you know, like, and the salon owners, the vast majority of them are like that. There is big businesses and salons as well, but like the vast majority, 95% of them are owner operated. You're helping a real person. Do you know what I mean?
So tangibly, you were physically seeing, if I can drop her no-shows by 50%, or
it actually put 8,000 euros into her pocket. And like, that was a lot of money.
But that's the difference between profitability and loss. Yeah, that's the difference between like a good year and a year where you're going, geez, we're probably not going to make it the next year. Like, so it's I love massive, this commitment.
Massive. Yeah. So I knew like there'd be, that idea was formulated, it was just strengthening all the time, that like, wanted to spend my life building a business with people who'd appreciate it, but also who are going to be nice, you know, and sound. And, you know, sometimes you might make a mistake, they'll be sound about it. Sometimes they'll make a mistake, you can be sound about it. Like, you know, someone that you can work together with.
The intentions are good.
And an industry where it made people feel good every day. Like, they really do. And, like, I realised then another thing, which really was the role that salons play in communities, which was really accentuated during COVID.
Yes.
Because, like, there was that period in COVID. And so I remember in May 2020, so like 3 months into COVID, and the most searched Google search term in Europe in like, I think like 15 of like whatever, 25 countries, the top one was, when will my salon reopen? you know, and like in everything that was going on in COVID, that was the number one search term. Like, just why was that? Like, people would have kind of dismissive of the industry up to that point. It's just this like, oh, there's those little salons or whatever. But the role that they play in the community is much bigger. Like, they bring this, it's in a small town, there might be no pub anymore, or there's no post office or whatever, but the salon is still there. The
social engagement.
There might be a cafe. You know, there's certain businesses that are still doing well on the high street. And they're a source of people, of employment, of communication, of connection, all that kind of stuff.
Regular connection as well. People know I'm going to go in every third week. I've chatted this about this with my barber recently. He's like, sometimes people just come in and tell me the wildest of things. They'll tell me the most intimate of things. And we were chatting about how it's kind of an intimate thing. You're sitting there.
It's really, but you're touching them.
Yeah.
Which is, how many strangers do you let to touch you?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, apart from shaking hands.
Yeah, the intimacy.
Like, if I came up behind you now and put my arms on your shoulders, it'd probably freak you out, right?
It's been a long day, I might.
Yeah, you might go, yeah. But not do a massage. I just put your hands there and say, are you okay, Gary? But like, they get to do that every day. Do you know what I mean? And you walk into a salon, you'll let whoever it is put their hands on your shoulders, touch your head.
And there's a bond and a trust.
And you do open up. Like, there's a whole science behind that, like, that I've now become aware of, obviously, being in the industry so long. But there's a whole science to that. Like, you let someone touch you, you trust them. And you trust them, but they know that you've trusted them back. So they can kind of, so how's things going? And you kind of look at them in through the mirror. And you kind of, a lot of people don't want to just say, ah, it's grand or whatever. They'll go, yeah, you know what? I'll just tell this person. Also, because they are a stranger. Because if it was their friend, they probably wouldn't, because it might involve someone they know. You know what I mean? But here's this stranger who I can trust, who can touch me, that I can tell this thing to, and they don't know who I'm talking about. Like, do you know what I mean? So it does do that. Like, it doesn't really get much kudos for that. Do you know what I mean? For playing that role in the community.
When you start to break it down and pull it apart, it's fascinating. So you worked there for the year.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the year, what happened?
It wasn't quite a year. So what happened was, we did that. That was going great. That was sort of before Christmas. It was back, the first Celtic Tiger. So it was like boom time. There was loads of people. The salon was rammed that Christmas. And the salon industry is very cyclical. Everyone, you know, especially then when everyone went to a Christmas party. Do you know what I mean? Whatever you were, you went to two or three Christmas parties.
Yeah.
So you go to the salon to get done up for that, and like, that was kind of how society kind of operated around Christmas time. It still does, but it was extra so then. So you'd have this rammed, and then after Christmas, like, no one goes into the salon for 3 months because they're broke, and you know, so the salons have this like peak and then this trough.
Okay.
And so that was my experience of that, because I was there, and then I remember coming in January, first week of January, and it's like the appointment book was empty.
Really?
And she's like, you know, looking at it, and this is another thing I learned, was, you know, how most people in the industry were, is like, when times are good, they're good, and then suddenly they're not good, and no one plans for that, because that's a small business thing. My dad did that as well. You kind of live in the moment, and the reason you live in the moment is because you're so busy. Like, you've so many things to do, you don't have time to sit down and plan what's
strategic planning isn't exactly
My dad, he's in the car doing the next delivery and collecting money off this guy and having to source the new cheese over there or whatever, so you don't have time to plan it out. And so January was empty, and you're like, shit, what do we do? We know March will be good, but we've got to get from now until March, got to hit payroll, got to, you know, pay the rent or whatever. And it was like, that was, I can't remember the exact moment, but I remember, like, it was over a few days, we were like, we had over 1,000 phone numbers that we collected from all our clients, sending the reminders. Could send a text message. We're like, why don't we send a promotion out to those numbers? And so we managed to get hold of like these little shampoos, like her Kerastase was her brand of shampoo that she sold. And they had this new range, and they had them. We got them for free for travel sizes of them as samples to give out to our clients. And so we sent out a text message to all the clients saying, if you book a haircut in January, we'll give you a free shampoo and conditioner of the, you know, the cool, newest, hottest new shampoo and conditioner that's available, right? And we sent that text message out on like a Wednesday, and it went out, and then nothing happened. You know, you send it out, nothing happened for about 7 or 8 minutes, and then the phone started ringing.
So 7 or 8 minutes,
we're like, all right. Ah, shit, we were just like, hopefully this will work. The phone started ringing. I was upset, so I was answering the phone. So I was just like, okay, oh yeah, cool. And she was like, yeah, I just got a text. Yeah, book me in for that, quick. You know, so I was booking it in.
Before they're all gone.
The phone just wouldn't stop ringing. We were all like grabbing the phones and it was just coming through. And we had that beep, beep when your phone on hold and everything. And we were just frantically booking these appointments in. And after 3 days, we'd booked out the whole of January, which is unheard of in a salon. Like, do you know what I mean? Even now, like, it's unheard of to do that. And so, and we were even booking them into February at that point. Do you know what I mean? Because we were like, people were forwarding the text to their friends.
Really?
And we didn't have anything. Oh, you have to have the original. You know, it was just like, well, who cares? It's not viral compared to, like, you know, TikTok or something, but it was a viral thing in terms of people were sending to their friends.
Was that the so-called eureka moment then for you?
The hairs have stood on, you know, there was a couple of moments. There was the one, you know, when that queue in Nassau Street or whatever, but the hair stood up on the back of my neck, but the third, when the phones wouldn't stop calling and I could just see the appointments going in, and I was just like, I think this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. Do you know what I mean? I was like, okay, this is it now. We have it now. You know, kind of felt that we were getting there, but now it's like, I have it now. I don't know. It won't maybe always be this, but I'm going to be working with salons for a long, long time, and we're going to be helping them do stuff because this is a great fucking feeling. And so, yeah, I hung around for a bit, but it was other salons started to ring in, like asking, what's that texting thing you got going or whatever? And I'd be like, yeah, I'll pass it on.
Like, let me patch it through.
Yeah. Hello. Yeah. So I was, I went back. We signed up a bunch more salons to it, and we charged them a little bit more because it was like specifically a salon thing now. You know, a salon appointment screen that lets you do reminders, but also send out promotions, and you could send out the promotion in the system, and it was very basic, but it was a salon only thing, so we could charge a bit more, and we had maybe, I think 15, 20 salons just using it as well. And we still had all the other companies using it. But we'd enough now when I went back to the business to actually start taking a salary. I mean, like, you know, 18 grand or whatever it was. Like, but take a salary and
how sweet was that feeling walking back in on day one?
It was really good feeling. And Jamie did it as well, that we both started paying ourselves on the same day. And it was a really good feeling. Like, it was kind of like, yeah, we have employees and ourselves, and it's all in our power. We're bootstrapped. You know, an investor can't tell us we need to do this or do that. We can decide what we want to do. Do you know what I mean? And we can take our time figuring it out. You know, we're not under any rush. We can do it ourselves. And that kind of really appealed to me. So it felt good. And that's really where Forest came from then. It came from that idea of, like, we're helping salons and we're helping them with the marketing, get busier. And that became our mantra, which was like, we help salons get their clients in more often, spending more, like that. It's still, you know, we don't use it as much as our mantra as we would have, because a lot of competitors kind of copied it eventually. You know, once we got more successful, a lot of the catchphrases got, you know, other people have a version of it. So we stopped. But for about 15 years, I would say, maybe a bit less, that was our phrase. Like, on our website, everywhere, it's just like, you know, we help you get your clients in more often, spending more. And,
not a bad offer.
Yeah, and then it went from text message promotions, then you know, start doing filters, and then you start doing emails, and then you start doing loyalty programs, and then you start giving them their own app in the app store for all their clients, for bookings, for, you know.
So you rode that wave of technological advancement into the smartphone era. You rode that wave into it.
Smartphone was great for us. Yeah, it was great. Like, all the, you know, moving to the cloud and everything, because at the start, the software was installed because you didn't have cloud software,
Of course, back then.
Well, some people did, but like not really.
So you had to go and install on their PC.
Yeah. We used to actually sell hardware for years. Like, I'd say for up until about 2017, we were selling PCs and
really
touchscreens. Yeah.
So you'd have to give them the whole package to put on
the
desk.
Yeah, you could buy the whole package. Like, obviously, by the time we'd stopped doing it, only about 10% of clients were still buying hardware. But when we first started, it was 90%.
Makes sense. Yeah, there's so things that we've never thought
yeah,
of.
Yeah. So we were like, well, we tried to sell the software, but people were like, yeah, but, you know,
do it?
Where's the rest of it? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, so cash drawers, receipt printers. We started basically point of sale equipment, and in our office, we'd have a little warehouse, and, you know, we have all these sourcing the computers and the all this stuff, we'd prepare it, and then someone would go out on site, train people up and install it on their desk, all that stuff, you know.
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, but as a result, we were able to charge quite a lot for it. So
right.
So I think we were charging like $7,000 for, and the equipment was probably costing us about $1,500.
Okay.
But it felt like $7,000 payment. Whereas like now, you know, if you were launching a SaaS business for sound software, you're charging like £50 a month, or you're free,
and yeah.
or you're £100 a month. You know what I mean? You need a lot more customers to pay the bills. Well, we only needed to, in those days, sell like 10 of those a month, and we were paying everyone's bills. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was a great experience. We split it. Jamie was the sales guy. I was everything else. So like he would sell it, and then I would go out and install it, do everything.
You were everything else. I love that.
Yeah, yeah. So, and supporting it and everything. And it was a fantastic couple of years. Like we, you know, I just drove driving up and down the country, had a little van. You know, just funny, I had the same van my dad had. So my dad had like this Peugeot Partner, like, I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, I remember them, yeah.
They're little, like, they're kind of like a small car van thing. And I had a Peugeot Partner as well.
And, nice little bit of synchronicity there, isn't there?
And there's a great picture I found the other day of both of us parked in our two Peugeot Partners outside our house where I'm from in Mayo. And it's a great picture. So it was like, you know, we'd both put our heads out the window, whatever. So it was kind of like, there was a little bit of kind of come back around to that. I'd load it up on a Monday morning, drive around the country. You'd spend overnights, you know, you'd be down in Donegal, or you'd be in Cork or wherever, install it, set them up, spend the day with them, make sure they really understood the product, of all course, that kind of stuff,
yeah.
And get to know them, and then learn about the industry every time. That product brand's good. That stylist doing well. That's a good manager there. You know, Mary up the road, she has it, you know, and you really get to understand salon owners and what they're about. And
you're building your moat as well, right? Yeah. You're building, every time you put one of these in, they're not going to rip it out the next week.
No, like it was very sticky, extremely sticky.
Great model.
It's not, yeah, like that, in many ways, yeah, it's just not like that anymore because, you know, technology changed, which has allowed us to scale as well. But then that like unbelievable stickiness isn't there anymore. Like there's just no churn because, like, you know what I mean? Like no one did, unless the salon went bust. Like,
yeah.
No one did, you know? So, but it allowed us, like, you know, 10 of those a month is like, you know, $70,000. That's like nearly $1 million a year.
You
actually didn't have to
money.
Do many to get a business going that paid all the bills, paid our office, had the staff, people on support and everything like that. So it allowed us to be bootstrapped. So I was really grateful for that. But I think what happened, like that was great. And then the big challenge for us came when the crash in 2007. Because it was an expensive purchase as well, right? So we were charging $7,000 to salons, and salons got like mashed all together in the crash. Because you can imagine people are cutting back.
Yeah.
And like, it's not that they're like, don't go to, they still need to get their hair cut.
They're not stopping, but
they're cutting
back.
They're like, I can only pay half of this. And so salons, you know, and then people are going, instead of going every month, people are going every 3 months and, you know, they're getting decimated. And so people start doing loads of offers. You know, we'll do cheaper. So everyone, the prices start to come down, which means they're making less money to keep it busy or whatever. And we, yeah, like I remember the cost, that $7,000 dropped about $4,000, you know, over the course of like a year or two. And we weren't able to, that business model as such, all those customers were our customers and they were still paying us monthly and sending texts and all that kind of stuff. So we had business from them, but we needed, like, Ireland wasn't big enough, you know, for us to get enough sign-ups every month or whatever. So that's when we went to the UK.
How long in business were you at this stage?
4 years.
Okay.
So that was 2007. We started going, we're going to have to go to the UK because Ireland was, and I think February 2008 was like the real, I seem to remember January and February 2008, I don't think anyone bought our system, you know, with no money coming in, except for the recurring stuff, which was at that time only maybe 20% of our revenue. Do you know what I mean? Because it wasn't fully SaaS or anything like that. So we were like, oh, fuck. You know, we were pretty panicky. And because we hadn't raised any money, we'd just been, this is one of the downsides to being bootstrapped. Or positives, you know, it depends on how you look at it. But when the downsides was basically this idea that we've no money in the bank ever. Like, you know what I mean? We spent what we had.
Right.
We never spent more than we had. But we never spent less than we had either. You know what I mean?
You were investing to grow, right?
Yeah, if there was if there's 10 grand in the bank, you know, and we had that every month, well, then we hired two people.
I gotcha.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and because we always needed more people to write the software or be on support, because the more customers we had, the more support issues we had. And then we had hardware issues as well. So you can imagine we'd have someone on the road driving around.
Of course.
When those receipt printers broke, we had to actually turn up. So it was quite heavy. It was quite a heavy thing to it. So we knew we had to go to the UK. And then around that time, Jamie stepped away as well, because Jamie, his real love and passion was kind of fitness rather than salons. And he went off to start his own sort of gym business around that time as well. So it's kind of on my own. This is kind of, right, Forrest, it's only me now. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Kind of. And what are we going to do? And so we just pulled the team together. And a couple of those guys, I'd say of those four or five key people back then, three of them are still in Forrest, believe it or not. And they were like, right, we're going to have to go to the UK. How are we going to do it? And I just said, I'll move there. Do you know what I mean? So, or I'll move there during the week. So I had a girlfriend who's now my wife, but it was still early enough. So we were, we didn't have kids or anything like that. So I was like, right, I'm going to go over on a Monday and come back on a sort of Thursday or Friday every week. And I'm going to just basically sell door to door, or we'll try and get leads around the country in the UK. Mm. And this other lady did the sales in Ireland, Sue, who's still with us as well. And so we kind of split it that way. And that was kind of the moment when Forrest went from just being an Irish business to being a, you know, more of an international business.
It's full commitment though, isn't it? Yeah. That's really like we're going at it. How did you break that down? Like, how did you like go, right, we're going to start with, because like the UK is so massive. How did you even break that down?
Yeah, well, we basically, I moved to London. So, well, I had friends living in London. So I took a flat with a couple of mates who were there anyway. So I had a room. And then we were just like, we'll try and keep it to the south of England.
Hmm.
And we bought a car over, you know, this. We were just doing everything on the cheap. So we like buy a secondhand car rather than like renting a car, because it's way cheaper. And like, so we had this car, a Vauxhall Astra or whatever. And we used to just drive, like fly in early morning flight, 6 a.m. flight, get this car, drive to wherever the salons appointments I could get. So we had a guy, you know, we were doing, at that point we probably had 17, 18 people in Forrest. So we had somebody working on marketing.
Okay, filling the funnel for you.
Yeah. We'd like a million, you know, we were doing about a million in revenue. So we had, you know, we had a team, and we were doing Google AdWords and stuff like that around that time. That's kind of where we probably started doing that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And like that, you know, so we were doing, there wasn't that many people bidding for salon software and Google AdWords. Like today, it's like mental. Like, you know, everyone does it. Because even the competitors then weren't even doing that, a lot of them. Do you know what I mean? So you're kind of, we would get picking up like demos around the UK, and I'd be going over, calling into the salon, and then I'd drop into the salon next door while I was, you know, if I was in Margate or Milton Keynes or Hull or like random place, like all across the UK. So I spent
That's serious graft.
And it was brilliant though. It was amazing. Like, I also never done sales before, because remember I was saying,
you were the other guy.
I never thought sales was my thing, but I just sort of threw myself into it because I had to.
Yeah.
But Jamie left, and you know, the business was not going to make it just in Ireland. And we always wanted to go abroad, you know what I mean, or whatever. Mm. So now's the time, you know, when the chips are down, you have to go and do it. So you kind of go, right, I'm going to have to start doing sales, and I'm going to have to start going abroad or whatever. So did that. It was an amazing experience. Drove all the way up and down the UK. Got to know, like, I've been to every town in England. Like, it's funny, people always say, and Ireland's beautiful, like, do you know what I mean? But a lot of England is actually beautiful as well.
It is.
Going to the New Forest and all these, like, down to Cornwall.
Snowdonia, like, Cornwall, amazing.
Up to the Highlands, Scotland. We've, you know, one of our first clients in Scotland was in Lerwick in Shetland Islands. We've a load of salons down in, you know, Guernsey and Jersey as well. Like, literally the whole thing.
That's class.
And it was cool. And like, you'd be in, I remember just mad things. Like, I was in this salon, one of our earliest salons in Scotland, bit after that one, and someone came in and said, "Dia Gwich," to the owner. And we were basically like right in the top, like about 2 or 3 hours north of Inverness. So like right at the top right of
next
Scotland,
stop,
right?
Norway.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And they were speaking Gaelic, like Gaelic, not Scots Irish or whatever, or Scots, you know, the Scots language.
That's
or whatever.
Bizarre.
They're speaking Gaelic. And it was weird. Like I had, you know what I mean? It was just like, there's just random things you experienced around the place that you'd never, there's no reason why anyone would ever go on holiday where I was. I couldn't even find a B&B to stay in. Like no That's one hilarious. Went there. It was just like sort of like rural farming.
And
area.
You ended up there selling them sound software.
It was only because of selling sound software. I happened to be there and I had to like stay like 40 minutes away because there was nowhere there.
How long did you do that for?
People would never go there. So you went to loads of places that you just never, but they have a salon because that salon was where all the women mainly who lived around there, you know, farmers' wives, different people, that's where they all went. Mm. It was this, it was just in the back of, she was, it was on a farm because her husband was a farmer and she'd built this like really successful salon business, like, you know, and you just on the coming farm. Across these mad places. And it was just fascinating experience. I loved it. Like,
so how long did you spend in the UK?
4 years.
Oh,
just until until I got married and my son was born.
Wow, that's serious going.
But amazing experience. And we built Forest up, like it's the number one provider of software to salons in the UK now, or has been for a long time. But we, you know, that was what got started. You know, I had to go there to do that. It wouldn't have happened, you know, if I hadn't thrown myself into it, you know. And once you've done in one country, then you're like, okay, you just believe you can do more countries. You know what I mean?
But I love that honest story of just hand-to-hand combat, door-to-door sales, because everyone's so bought into like the hype of social media, and social media is incredible. But, you know, hard graft is needed too.
And you kind of need to enjoy that. I think one of the things, like, I know you, one of the things you always, what advice do you have for people? And it's like, I don't know what, like, do you know what I mean? Like, everyone has their own story. And also, what are you selling? What are you building? Like, do you know what I mean? You know, if you start a social media company, you're not going to be doing the hard graft going around selling it door to door. Like, do you know what I mean? It just depends on, obviously, the product. The product we had made sense to do that. The people we were selling to were real people, busy lives, and they liked to see someone. Do you know what I mean? They like to look at you in the eye and go,
it's a people business.
They're like, what's this tech stuff? And, you know, explain it to me. Do you know what I mean? And like, okay, and if there's a problem,
You're
looking your white in your eyes. Yeah, we'll be there. And I'll be like, yeah, we'll be there for you. You know, whatever. So
I think business, especially tech business, I need to go back to that. I was at an e-com conference last week in Belfast and we were discussing that, you know, just even having a phone number and an address on your website. Mm. Be real. Have a human being at the end. That's how a lot of tech companies are now like trying to differentiate themselves, kind of going back to the traditional of like, just call Roland.
Well, I really think... AI means in-person selling is going to become bigger again. Most of our sales now would be online, Zoom calls, all that kind of stuff. You know, we definitely, with COVID and everything like that, all that in-person stuff, we had to reimagine it. But also our customers were ready. You had an excuse not to do it. Whereas before, if you stopped doing it, someone else was going to do it. You know, so everyone got used to that. And it worked really well. But you don't have the same connection. Like, when we used to go out to sell it in person and then somebody go out to set you up, the connection that you had with those customers, so many of them are still our customers today. It was like a real deep connection. And they know who you are. You just don't get that online, even though you can sign more people up and you can grow faster. But it does miss that bit. And I just think with the AI stuff, I notice all these AI tools, and we use AI in our product. But with sales, there's a lot of talk about, you're going to be able to automate like SDRs and all these conversations and everything like that, or all these emails you're going to get. You're going to just receive an email from someone and they're going to know all about you, so it's going to be the most perfectly written email.
Yeah.
But if you receive the most perfectly written email every 5 minutes from someone else about different things, they're no longer, you know, it doesn't matter how well it's written.
People don't get. Yeah.
It's just, you don't trust any of it. You're just going to go, shut down your LinkedIn.
That's why I do these conversations in person. It's way more work. It's way more expense. But there's nothing like it. If we did this online, it'd be a totally different conversation. The nuance is different. The facial expression is different. The body language is different. If I meet you online, I've met you. But when I meet you in person, I know you.
Yeah.
Like there's a personal and connection
there's an effort.
There's
an effort that you have to make for it, which is a natural kind of
precisely
barrier, I think, to entry. When there's no barrier to entry and everything is amazing, it's all garbage. I think people, so I think in sale, I think we're already starting to go back in person now, particularly in the US, which would be our main market now, much more in person, And in the US, it's kind of a bit further down the line. Like, they embrace kind of online, SMBs embrace online sales much more than, much quicker than in Europe, because smaller countries, you know, if you're operating in Ireland, you can kind of probably meet whoever's selling it to you, stuff like that.
That's easier. You're kind of a 3-4 hour drive from anyone, really. Yeah. Like, it's not that big a deal.
But in the States, they kind of embrace that stuff quicker. And so all, a lot of companies selling software, technology and things like that, you know, into small businesses like salons or whatever, that all migrate online faster. But we're noticing when you go out in person and we're trying to build up our sale, our own sales channel, outbound channels that we can, you know, for us, if we fly to Atlanta, we need to meet a load of salons for it to make sense. Mm. So we're trying, just getting better and better at doing that. And the results are just way better. Like, we just get much better clients, you know, much more committed clients, much lower churn from them. You know what I mean? And the more you do of that, the better, the more of that you get. And we notice that none of our competitors are doing it. Do
you zig when other people zag. I think that's the key thing. And you've been in the industry so long. You've seen trends come and go. You've seen what works. You've seen patterns. You've seen what's bad versus an actual shift in the momentum. What's your thoughts on kind of like the B2B SaaS space at the minute? Because, you know, it's got so busy and so noisy.
Yeah, well, it's basically just software. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, B2B SaaS is any piece of software that does something for a business, right? Which is basically probably the majority of software companies sell to businesses, right? Because consumers, how many software companies sell to consumers? It's very few, you know what I mean? Like, every vertical has a load of different things. You know, if I work in the finance department for any company, there's probably like 1,000 different software tools I could use or buy. Do you know what I mean? If I work in HR, same thing, you know? So, like, if you're going to build a tech company, you know, the probability is, if you're going to succeed, the probability is it's going to be some sort of B2B SaaS application. Because even if it's an AI thing, you know, if you're bringing some sort of AI nuance to some problem that you're solving, it's probably going to be delivered in the form of a monthly fee. Do you know what I mean? For that solution. So you're basically B2B SaaS still, even if you're AI or whatever you're using. Do you know what I mean? So I think, you just got a better chance of succeeding if you understand the problem in a business, and a business usually has money to spend on something. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I was just curious because you see people like, people now kind of moving away towards the kind of once-off fees. I think, you know, certain companies are experimenting with once-off fees. So I was kind of curious to see, as someone who's in the SaaS space, what do you see? What's your kind of long-term goal for Forest? Because you have a very unique take on going long. You're at it 20 years now. Mm. What's your long-term goal? Has it remained the same?
I don't have, like, a goal. Like, you know, that I could say, oh, I want to serve 1 million salons, or I want to, you know, achieve 1 billion in revenue or something like that. I don't really have a goal like that. It's more that I wanted to be able to be in charge, like, not have someone telling me what to do for my career, and work on one thing, you know, work on one business and grow that as far as I could and see what happened. And I still have that goal to know as far as it can go. And I think it's still got a long way to go. You know, I still think we only have 11,000 customers in this 1 million salons. Do you know what I mean?
I love how you say only 11,000. People are like, wait, what?
But, like, there's I'm not saying that all 1 million salons could ever use Forest, because ours is it's an expensive product. It's for, you know, it's for premium salons, or salons that aspire to be premium. Mm. You know, like, that's what Forest is. So it's not for everyone. But there's certainly more than 11,000 salons like that around the world. You know, we worked out the other day, it's about 150,000 of them. So we've a long, you know, in terms of market share, we've loads to go. And then even when we serve those salons, there's loads of cool things we can do, help them with other problems that we haven't even figured out yet. Do you know what I mean?
I love that. Long-term ambition. You raised cash subsequently then, after bootstrapping for so long. Why?
Yeah, that was it was definitely a psychological challenge to do that, because we become like we were bootstrappers, you know, that was what we did. But I think like I was kind of very anti fund, you know, I probably became a little bit dogmatic about it. Like, you know, I was kind of anti funding, like bootstrapping forever, bootstrap till you die and all this sort of stuff, which was fun to do at the time. But like in hindsight, it was just because I was just quite anti VC or something. Do you know what I mean? But like now I don't view it like that. You know, like I think some businesses need funding, and or at certain times a business needs funding and you've got to get that funding, and you know, where's that money going to come from? So we had built a business that was doing $1 million, you know, your turnover or whatever, but we needed to fully embrace the cloud, and we didn't have the money to hire the developers that we needed to build a cloud product, because the developers we had, you know, were specialized in the kind of on-premise technology that we had back then in the late 2000s. So we needed to hire some pretty expensive people to do it. And especially then, like now there's a lot more people able to do that kind of stuff. Back then, you know, as technologies develop, it gets easier to do things. But back then it was quite a more difficult thing to do, or to find people like that would come and work for you. So when we didn't have any money to pay them, you know, so we raised like €1 million from a bunch of angel investors and Enterprise Ireland and stuff like that. And that was 2011. And that allowed us to hire a CTO, a new CTO, a bunch of devs, and also spend a bit more on marketing and sales in the UK. So I was able to hire salespeople in the UK to allow me to come back to Dublin. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
Which suited me personally anyway, because for family and stuff like that, I didn't want to be traveling all the time then, you know, once you had a family and stuff. So that allowed us to do that, and we wouldn't have been able to do it without that injection. And how would we have got money? Like, a bank wouldn't have lent us, especially then, like $1.5 million. They just wouldn't have. Plus you'd have had that debt hanging over you. So investment capital makes sense, you know what I mean? So, and we had a future, we had a big opportunity. So I just had to kind of come to terms with, actually, you know, the world isn't black and white. Do you know what I mean? It's not like it's bootstrapping or you're selling your soul to the devil, which is what I'd been telling myself and other people, you know.
It's evolution though, isn't it? As an entrepreneur, that's evolution. And then in terms of the angels, do they see...
They brought like, we were really lucky. Like some of those angels are still in the company today. And we got this guy called Pat Garvey, who became the chairman of the company. And so we didn't have a board, or we hadn't had any formality to the way we'd run things. So I kind of did get a boss, but it was the right thing to do. And this guy called Pat Garvey, who was our chairman up until about a year and a half ago. And he's a very successful entrepreneur in Ireland. He founded a company called SharpTech, which basically became DCC, which is really well known. You know, a couple of billion turnover. That he was the founder of that. And so he, you know, very successful tech entrepreneur from an early wave of tech in Ireland. So seen it all, invested in loads of companies, had been chair on public companies, you know, just had done everything. And we were like-minded, but very different as well. Different skill sets, but it worked really well.
And when angels come in, they come in with the expectation of getting out.
Yeah.
So how does that tie with your long-term vision?
So we after about 5 or 6 years, one of our investors was a seed capital fund called ABC Capital. And their fund had come to end of life. So I didn't understand all this stuff back then, but I understand now. You know, when you raise a fund, you invest for 7 years, and then it's kind of after 10 years, you want to have realized most of your gains, right? They were coming to that end, that 10-year horizon after 5 or 6 years. So they were like, what's the story? And I was like, well, I don't really want to sell Forest. And they're like, yeah, but we kind of need our money back. So what's going to happen? And Forest going really well. You're one of our good investments because you've grown loads, you know what I mean? And because we'd probably gone from 1 million to maybe 10 million. And at that point, it was 10 million ARR because it was all recurring revenue by that point. So we'd made that transition, gone really well, gone into some more countries, you know, things were going really well. So we had to find an investor, but I didn't want to bring in VC. Plus VC mightn't have come in anyway. to something like Forest because it was quite old at that point. You know, it was over 10 years old. VCs are kind of, you know, to get in at the start to see the big rocket ship or whatever. Yeah. And Forest was kind of more of a steady eddy. So we went out and I met about 60 private equity firms over the course of about a year until and each one I said, I want someone long-term who's going to back long-term. Because I needed somebody who was prepared to invest now for, if the company was doing really well, they'd stay. They weren't under any commitments to we have to get out after 3 or 4 years. And most of the private equity firms have 3 to 5 year horizons. So that wasn't the right source of capital for Forest. But we found two in the end and we went with one. And it was basically someone who was genuinely long-term. They're not a typical private equity firm. And basically how it works is the people who are really long-term, it's really family money. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
It's called private equity, but it's probably the money probably comes from some kind of family endowment or some really rich entrepreneur who's put a load of money that he wants to invest, but he doesn't. It's his money, so he doesn't need to return money to his
LPs or shareholders. It's not going to make them or break them next year if they get.
Yeah, and if the business is going well, it's keep the money in. Like, what's the point? It's growing more than the stock market. You know, as long as you're growing over 15% a year, you're growing faster than what it'll make in the stock market. Do you know what I mean? So.
Plus, with your track record, you're an outlier. Like it's fascinating. Thanks for explaining that because there's a lot of nuance in bootstrapping and then raising funding. So thanks for explaining that and being so open because I think it's really important for people to kind of see both sides of it.
Like one of the things we've done, which I will say, is that we made sure that the majority of the company is still owned by myself and the employees. So Forest employees have share options, but they also have a share purchase scheme. So people are able to buy in if they want. Mm. And so 25% of the company is actually owned by the employees directly. Nice. So that means that the final say always comes down to, us or me, you know what I mean? Like, so I get that final say, and it was important to kind of to maintain that structure so that, yes, you know, we are going long term and the final decision rests with us. We don't have somebody saying, right, it's time to sell today or tomorrow. Do you know what I mean?
Beautiful.
So I think and it's worked out well. And thankfully those guys, they invest under that mindset. They think that if they invest in companies that go longer or that the founder will know, you know, when the founder wants to get off, that's the time to get off, as opposed to when we say the time to get off, that they'll get better returns and they'll get better companies. I mean, which to be fair, they have some great businesses in there, but it's less about the show. It's more about building a really good business and stuff like that.
I love to see that. I love more companies to take that long-term approach. Do a quick fire round.
Okay.
What book would you recommend every entrepreneur should read?
Two. I would say first one, the one that had the biggest impact on me is definitely Good to Great, Jim Collins, which I presume other people have said in this chair.
Yeah,
before.
It's come up a good few times.
It's just a fantastic book. It's a bit dated now, but it's, you know, in terms of the companies it talks about. But the things in it, like core values, you know, having a mission, taking the long-term approach, really understanding what are the key business metrics that are going to make you money. Like all those lessons I learned by reading that book 5 or 6 times, and everyone in our management team would have read it years ago and we, you know, catch up on it again. It's just the business fundamentals are so well explained in that book. So I love that.
It's a cracking book.
You can't go wrong with that one. And then more, there's a book called by Richard Rummel called Good Strategy, Bad Strategy. And
that's black and white cover.
Yeah. And that's probably my favorite ever business book. I go through phases of reading loads of business books and then, you know, but over the years I've read a lot. I had to learn a lot from books and audiobooks as opposed to having learned it myself. Do you know, that's how would you learn how to build a sales force? You read a lot of stuff and you make silly mistakes then or whatever. So, but that book on strategy is just unbelievably good. I can't recommend that high enough.
I think that's the first time it's been recommended. Brilliant. What's something you didn't pay enough attention to early on and had to learn the hard way?
Probably planning. So I kind of existed, we kind of lived hand to mouth for so long that you just get really good at reacting in the moment, and if something goes wrong, you fix it. And that became kind of a culture. That doesn't work as well when you have 300 or 400 people and business units in different countries and things like that. Mm. That kind of just flying by the seat of your pants, which is a lot of fun doesn't work. And we probably flew by the seat of our pants for longer than we should have, you know, when you kind of need to just plan things out better. And I'd say even today we could be better at it. I'm not saying that we're good at it because we're not. But we, you know, you as every year goes by, I appreciate that side of things more.
Mm. As the company evolves. Mm. What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
I don't think I've actually sacrificed. And I mean, there's definitely been like times that I maybe didn't go to see my parents, you know, because I had to go travel to some business meeting or something. You know, there's things like that. But generally speaking, I think I've probably sacrificed the growth of the business more. Like one of the things that of being able to have your own business, be in control of it, is that like after I moved to the UK and I moved home, I probably should have moved to America for Forest. You know what okay. I mean? Like if I'd moved to America then, Forest would probably be a bigger company today. But I wasn't going to do that. I wasn't going to do that. The sacrifice that would have made for my family and things like that, I wasn't prepared to make. So it was like, we have to do it, but it's going to take longer and we're going to have to do it.
I think that's a good trade-off.
Without travel. So, yeah, so I'm kind of, you know, I'm not saying, you know, obviously, like work consumes me when I'm in work. Outside of work, it doesn't consume me as much as it would have, you know. Like I finish work at 5 or 6 o'clock every day. I rarely work late, you know. I rarely travel, really. Probably only travel the States twice a year, you know. Like we have really good people. It's forced me to have good people to do those things, you know what I mean? But it's meant that it's taken longer.
But that's a healthy approach, though. I think more people could take that approach. What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
I don't know. Next question. Because I give it to charity, I suppose, you know.
That's fair enough. What's something important in your daily routine you wish you started sooner?
So this is going to sound so fucking boring, but like, you know, like I drink less now, I sleep better, I eat better and all those kind of things, which 10 years ago I didn't do. I got, you know, like every fucking tech bro in the world, you know, like you're kind of interested in all those things. And it probably could have started those younger, but then at the same time, maybe, but then I had a lot of fun as well, so fuck it. Like, you know what
it's
I mean?
A balance,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah,
and you get to a certain age, you get a bit more sense.
Exactly.
I'm going to give you 1 million euro. You can invest in one company or one person. Who would that be?
Games Workshop, I would say.
Games Workshop, okay.
That is an amazing company. It's been around for, it's family, it's a public company in the UK. You know Games Workshop, I'm sure you know there, but just... businesses like that, I love them. It's that business will keep growing forever. You know what I mean? Because their customers are like obsessed fans. You know, it's like Lego or something, but even more obsessed. Do you know what I mean? So
big Lego fan, hence the Lego tattoo. If you just start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
I see, because I love this. I started this when I was younger and that's what I wanted to keep doing. And if this comes to an end, because like, you know, I don't want it to come to an end, but just say it comes to an end for something outside of my control or whatever, that's it. I'll definitely help other people if they want my help or whatever and advisory and all that stuff, but I won't do another company because it's just something I wanted to do once, but do it really well. You know what I mean?
What a brilliant answer. Your life's work. What do you believe that other people find strange or strongly disagree with?
What we were talking about earlier, I think that the rise of AI is going to result in in-person sales way more. And I've said this to a few people. They're like, what are you talking about? It's all going to go to AI. But I'm like, well, if everyone can do it, people will not listen or read any emails or anything like that. They just stop because if it's all generated.
Yeah.
It means every email they get is amazing. They just won't believe any of it unless somebody looks them in the eye and says, I'm a real person. This is why this is true. Do you know what I mean? So, I think we're going to see an increase in that in-person stuff.
I like it. It's contrarian, but I'm bullish with it as well. I'm a big believer in in-person events. Mm. I think events, conferences, in-person experiences are going to absolutely rocket. What's one thing you spend money on in your personal life that brings you immense happiness?
Probably two things. One is I go on a date night with my wife every Wednesday night and cannot recommend that high enough. to anybody. And secondly, just paying for, again, going back, like paying for a personal trainer twice a week, you know. I've only been in that for a few years, but it just makes your life better. It's worth doing, you know.
Good answer. Stay nice, strong. We do monthly breakfasts or dinners. That's our thing. Yeah. Monthly, every month we have a.
Yeah. Well, like I'd say, we like if we get two or three done a month, it's good. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? You're not going to get every week, but try to.
It's powerful. I mean? Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just make a commitment to yourself. Finally, what's your piece of advice for every founder or aspiring founder listening?
It's a marathon. Like, you know, I think there's a. If you want to win, like win with your business in whatever vertical or sector or segment that you're in, if, and this isn't the only thing, but I think if you're prepared to last longer, you have a better chance of winning. You know, you don't have to necessarily have the best product, or the most funding or any of those things. But if you can last the pace and you're prepared to just keep going, it's like the hare and the turtle, you know, in the race. I've seen so many companies in our space come in, raise loads of money and burn out, even when they were like beating us and everything with that money. Cause they just, it was all a bit too much. And they kind of, we were just like, well, we'll just let this burn out and we'll still be here. You know what I mean? And like these things come, they punch you, you take the punches, but you still stay standing. And if you kind of take that attitude, like you just have a much better chance of winning, I think.
Be consistent, be sound, keep going.
Yeah.
It's weird. Me and Ben had that exact conversation before you walked through the door. So it's so funny to hear you say the same thing. Where can people learn more about Forest and also maybe about yourself?
Well, about Forest, we've a website called nothingventured.rocks, which is our blog in Forest where we talk about how we work and things like that. And we used to be very active on that. There's a lot of stuff about bootstrapping. So there's some articles there, which I think is good, is of a state in time, which was right, and it's changed. But we're about to get very active on it again. And but there's a lot of good stuff there, I think.
Perfect. Ronan, that was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Cheers. I enjoyed it as well. Thanks, Gary.
Thanks for watching. Hope you enjoyed that one. If you did, do me two quick favors. Hit like on the video. And leave a quick comment. It really helps the channel to grow, especially when it's a small channel like this. If you enjoyed that kind of content, click here to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And click here to watch a brand new video right now. I'll see you back here next time.